Starting on the 13th of October 2022, myself and five other military veterans, including Ash Alexander Cooper and Des Fraser, will be carrying a 75 kg stretcher 125 miles non-stop to raise funds and awareness for the suicide prevention charity, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, otherwise known as CALM. The 75 kg represents the weight of the average person in the UK, and 125 miles represents the amount of deaths by suicide each week in this country. For more information, check out the links in the show notes. Please spread the word or donate. Thank you so much and enjoy the episode. My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this special episode, we talk about the history of stretcher bearers, focusing on the First World War. We speak about what they did, their kit, heroics, trauma training, and respect. We also talk about the methods of carry, firing squads, and suicide. From the carry to the Kazivac, a stretcher bearer special with Dr. Emily Mayhew. This is Declassified. Emily, what is a stretcher bearer?
So I'm going to talk a lot about stretcher bearers from the First World War, but this is where we first see the role being defined and transformed. So a stretcher bearer is someone who goes to the point of wounding. They aren't someone who waits for a patient or a casualty to be brought to them. They are a person who goes out and finds the casualty. And in the First World War, this became about something radically different from what had gone before. They administered care to the person at whose point of wounding they were, and they made them strong enough so that they could be transported, receive care on the way, on their journey, and then be taken on to the next phase of medical care, which was usually a field hospital. So a stretcher bearer is someone who bears casualties, who bears the weight of casualties, but also bears the weight of keeping that person alive.
And did they always have stretcher bearers? Like when the British Expeditionary Force first went over to France, did they take stretcher bearers with them? And if they did, who were they?
They didn't take stretcher bearers as we understand them now with them. They took soldiers who were, and I'm literally quoting this, considered to be too big or too stupid to do proper soldiering. And they thought that all they would do is carry someone off the battlefield. So that was all they had to do, was they had to be able to bear a weight. And it was very quickly realised that there were far too many casualties for people to cope with in the initial phases. That journey from the point of wounding to the field hospital or the casualty clearing station was much too long. And the person that went to the point of wounding had to be someone with a little bit about them, as a medical officer once wrote, had to be someone with initiative who'd received some basic medical training. So for 3 months, say from September to the end of November 1914, stretcher bearers are people too big or too stupid to do proper soldiering. But from January 1915, they are what we now call a paramedic. They can give care at the point of wounding, and they can give care in transport. It's an absolute transformation.
And was that on a kind of like on the job training, or was they new guys coming over from the UK?
So they were new,
well trained.
They were new recruits. They were people who had volunteered, who'd come in because it was an all-volunteer army at that point. And the ones that looked like they might have some useful experience for stretcher bearing, for working in a medical capacity, were steered towards a brand new stretcher bearing course at a military hospital in Aldershot. And there they learnt about carrying a load. So, for instance, they trained to carry a 12-stone dead weight, even though whenever they got to France, they realised that that was the minimum that they would be carrying. That's very light for a soldier. We don't have 12-stone soldiers anymore, I don't think. But they would be carrying more likely 14 or 15 stones when you have a soldier who's injured, plus rain-sodden clothing and mud and all the other things that can end up on your stretcher. So they receive 6 weeks training in England, and then the rest of it is expected to be on the job. And the point about the Western Front in January of 1915 is that everybody is learning on the job. It's just the stretcher bearers are learning further forward in the battle than anyone else.
And is it localized training then, like on the job training once they're there in January? Or is someone overseeing the full development of stretcher bearers?
It's one of the really interesting things that the stretcher bearers tell us is that it's very localized. So they're assigned to a regimental medical officer who is supposed to oversee their training. But the regimental medical officers are smart people, and they realize this thing that everybody's going to learn, that this isn't going to be a teacher-pupil relationship. This is going to be the creation of a multidisciplinary team, some of whom has a medical degree and some of whom doesn't, and they're going to learn together. So it's really localized, and it's one of the points at which the British Army doesn't get enough credit, because they recognise that the local training, just leaving it up to the men in the field, is going to be where the value is. So nobody's overseeing them, nobody's telling them where they should go, giving them a textbook. The only time where you do get an organised training facility is once gas starts to be used in 1916. And then they come back and they go to training camps closer to the French coast, and they are trained to carry with a gas mask on and to experience what it's like to go through a gas attack, because that becomes really complicated when you're carrying a stretcher.
And you mentioned there, so time is moving on. Could you give an overview of those 4 years of where it started and where it ended with, in terms of development, in terms of kind of competency of the stretcher bearers?
The thing about long wars is everybody gets really good at, I'm going to say fighting them, but participating in them. And the stretcher bearers go from being people who can make decisions about who to carry, who can make decisions about the carry itself. And that's what stretcher bearers call casualty evacuation. They talk about a carry. They come back and say, I had a very difficult carry today. They learn about mud and rain. They learn how physically demanding it is. And by the end of the war, they are recognizably what we would call paramedics. They're capable of controlling hemorrhage. They can give a morphine to a patient. They can organize a small medical unit. They are like today's CMTs and paramedics. They're really the people you want around you if you've been badly injured, because they know how to keep you alive moment by moment. So they go from quite basic understanding of moving an injured man, to keeping that man alive moment by moment when they have some really significant complex casualties. And they do all their learning, let's not forget, under fire.
Do they go over the top with the men, or are they after?
So they go about 20 seconds after. There's the scene that you're used to from the films, you know, where the men are waiting and they've got their ladders and the officers blow the whistle and they roar and go over the top. And early in the war, they used to say to the stretcher bearers who are waiting in the forward trenches, who are waiting with their stretchers, they used to say, oh, get a rifle, do some fighting. You know, what's the point of you? Very quickly, the soldiers learn, don't do that. You're going to need a number of you are going to need them. So the soldiers go over the top using the ladders, and the stretcher bearers pull the ladders back, and they go about 20 seconds later. So they go into a point where the shells are going off and the firing has started. They are by and large unarmed. And what they're doing is they're not listening for the rifle fire. They're listening for the screams of the wounded. So they are going up seconds after the main attack waves have gone. They're very much a part of that, but they're an unarmed part and they're doing a completely different job.
There's a couple of parts to this. Firstly, what is the ratio of stretcher bearer teams to the men? A battalion or whatever. And then the next thing is, how many are in a stretcher bearer team?
So you have, first of all, the stretcher bearer team is ideally 5 to 6 people. Because ideally, if you think about a stretcher, it's got 4 handles on each corner. You want one person on each of those handles and one person walking ahead to direct them into a trench, away from a shell hole, you know, away from shell fire. So that's ideal. But we know that stretcher bearers become at a premium as the war goes on. So people learn to do it with 4, 3, or then 2. and the stretcher is heavy and the patient is heavy. So two is not ideal. I think that's what we tend to think of, but two is not ideal. Everything's very heavy. And the more men you have, the quicker you can move. And then they're battalion-based stretcher bearers. You have some in the movable field ambulances. A battalion is about 1,200 men. It will have one regimental medical officer and probably 8 stretcher bearers. The team numbers will be doubled up when that battalion is being sent into a battle. So then there'll be 16 stretcher bearers. And that becomes the basis of the medical team for the battalion. 17, maybe 9 men, but in times of fighting is 17 men. It doesn't seem like very much, but it's extraordinary what they managed to do.
So 2, 3, maybe 4 teams to 1,200 men?
Yes.
And then in somewhere like the Somme, where there was catastrophic injuries like never seen before and hopefully never again, how many men would they be bringing back, like in an hour? I don't even know if that's even possible to even put a finger on it.
We don't have very good numbers. Actually, we never have very good numbers for CASAVAC, because the people keeping statistics think that the only important thing to write down is the operation, you know, when they had the surgery and how that went, which is quite disappointing, because they forget that someone's had to keep them alive in order to get them into the operating theatre, but that's another story. So stretcher bearers go out into the Somme, and they will all have as many stretcher bearers that have been allocated as possible. So it's 16 men per battalion. It may be that they're able to bring people back, maybe 1 or 2 people per hour. They'll be carrying all day and all night, and they will be carrying back to medical facilities that are overstretched. So we know from the Somme that a lot of stretcher bearers would arrive and they would put stretchers down outside the field hospital. And the field hospitals were like little island tents in a sea of stretchers. So it's very obvious to the bearers that they're just adding to the problem, you know, that the medical system in the first week of the Somme really doesn't cope. We have, I think it's 17 stretcher bearers who get VCs during the First World War. And what they have in common is that their citations read something like tended and carried to the wounding during the Battle of the Somme or the Battle of Passchendaele, one of those big showpiece battles that we know well, tended and carried the wounded during the battle for four days without ceasing. So that's what they do. Their response to that many casualties is just to work and work and work until they can't work anymore.
Work until as many lives are saved.
As many lives are saved as possible. And hopefully somebody has said to them, that is enough. You stop, because, you know, people can't work forever. An experienced stretcher bearer is gold. It's gold and diamonds and platinum and whatever else you want to say. So you don't want them wearing themselves out. You don't want them becoming weak so that they don't hear the sniper who's targeted them. You want them to be able to pace themselves. And it's one of the things stretcher bearers get very good at. Well, there's two. Number one, they eat when they're hungry. Whenever they can see food, they eat it, because they know they're going to need it. And the other thing is they can fall asleep in 3 seconds flat. They can take a nap wherever they can. They curl up into a hole in the trench and they just go to sleep. And then everybody knows, don't disturb the stretcher bearers, because you want them to be alert and awake. So hopefully after 4 days, somebody tells them to stop, because everyone's life is at risk if they don't.
Were they targeted by not so much artillery fire later on, because that's obviously fairly indiscriminate, but would German soldiers snipe them or try and shoot them, and vice versa?
We know that both enemy German soldiers and British soldiers targeted each other's bearer parties, because nothing was worse for morale than to see a bearer party go down. And so I have a record of a bearer party where each one of the 4 plus the 5th leader on the front is picked off by a sniper one by one. And the casualty is left and they fall to the ground and the stretcher falls to the ground. And the casualty is left still alive, which is how we know about it, because he went back and reported it. He got back eventually, and he was surrounded by dead stretcher bearers. And to see that your stretcher bearers have gone out and not come back, that's really bad for battalion morale. And so both sides eventually, you know, we think of the Christmas truce, but that kind of that kind of respect was short-lived. And by the end of 1915, they were shooting at bearer parties, they were shooting at anything that moved.
So all ethics, all values, just there was no... And does that go against the Geneva Convention?
The Geneva Convention is applies, but it doesn't apply. I mean, soldiers aren't taught about it. And no point are soldiers taught about it. It just becomes, war becomes this dirty grinding. We need to, it's a war of attrition. You know, that was what they wanted. We wanted to kill more of them than us, because the person who killed more of the other side was the person who was going to win the war. So it becomes about something very basic, not about honour and chivalry, but about attrition.
Apart from carrying the stretcher, which makes them obvious, did they wear any kind of insignia? Did they wear the Red Cross?
Not in the beginning, and then they ask for it. So they ask for what we call a brassard, which is an armband, and it's a plain white band with a band with a Red Cross on it. But they found out that it doesn't make a great deal of difference to if someone's targeting you. And just as you say, when the artillery shells get going, they're being fired from 2 miles back. All that they're firing at is a slow-moving target, which 5 stretcher bearers and a patient is very slow-moving. So they have it, and also because generally, as they go on, their sense of self, their sense of value as a stretcher bearer grows, and they want to be identified as part of the medical team because they're fundamental. No stretcher bearers, no survivors. No stretcher bearers, everybody injured on the Somme dies. It's a very different kettle of fish from the history that we know today.
Mm. I think they're undervalued as well, not to go into this. And it wasn't until I listened to a 90-minute webinar that you did that I realised how celebrated they should be, and how brave and how almost ferocious in their instinct to look after people was. What was the kit? So start with a stretcher. How was it made up?
Well, the basic design of the stretcher hasn't changed very much, but the design in the Great War was 2 long wooden sticks carved into handles at the end, and then a canvas, cradle where the patient would go. So it was thick canvas stitched around the handles. And then they had straps at every corner, leather straps at every corner. And it's a good sturdy thing. It rolls up. It can be carried quite easily. If you've seen the film 1917, I was very happy to see that they had a lot of stretchers stacked up in some of the trench scenes, because you always run out of stretchers and you really don't want to. But although they're sturdy, although they roll up and they can be carried, the Western Front's a very hard place for everyone, including an inanimate object like a stretcher. So when it's wet, when it's cold, or when it's hot, that wood splinters, the handles splinter. They get a lot of sweat in them from the hands, and they splinter, and so that damages the hands that hold them. The leather straps get stiff. They're not supple, so they bear down on the shoulders of the man who's supporting them. And the canvas absorbs a lot of water. So the stretcher itself is part of the weight that they're carrying. So they may be carrying a 12-stone dead weight, but the stretcher is going to be a stone and a half if it's really wet. And it's going to have really damaged their hands, and it's going to give them back problems for the rest of their lives. In some of the letters that I read, and this is part of the problem why we don't know about them, they weren't great letter writers. They didn't write poems. They didn't keep diaries. They didn't write novels. They're not those sort of people. That's for nurses and doctors to do that kind of reflection after the war. They go back to their ordinary jobs and they don't realise what they've done. But one of the things that we know from their family accounts is that their mothers would often, when they go home for their first leave, turn over their hands and burst into tears because of the damage that had been done to their palms by carrying these heavy stretcher handles. So it's really, in addition to saving a life moment by moment, you're doing really physically demanding work, at the heart of which is a human who would die if you don't do that work.
And then going off that, then if we're looking at 1915 to 1918, what kit was these paramedic stretcher bearers carrying?
So they're also carrying a satchel. And that's full of dressings. So it's full of dressings and dressing pads. which they need mostly for stopping controlling hemorrhage. That's always the issue in war. You blow great holes in people, they bleed to death unless you can stop them bleeding. So they carry bandages and they carry dressing pads, most of that. They stuff them, if you think of it like a school satchel, they stuff that into every single corner that they possibly can. They've also got bottles of water. The chances are if a man's been in a shell hole for a couple of days, he can't drink the water because it's shell hole water. So it wants clean water, and the first thing they can do is give them a drink. They also carry little packs of morphine because they are trained to give morphine, although they realise that a man who's unconscious when he's on the stretcher is a man who can't tell them if his wounds have started to hurt. And so they prefer not to use morphine, although there are times when they know they can't bring a man back that they will ease his passing with their morphine supplies. And then they also always carry wrapped up in leather so that it doesn't get wet, they carry matches and a packet of cigarettes. Because if someone's going to die and everybody knows they're going to die, the chances are the last thing they're going to want is a smoke. And so they can give them a cigarette and they can light it for them and they can sit back on their heels and help the man out of the world.
And we talk about helping men out the world, and I don't know if we know this. It just popped into my head. Did they carry arms? Did they carry a sidearm? And if they did, would they ever consider putting someone out of their misery? Especially if there's facial problems and all that.
I've never heard of a stretcher bearer using a weapon to do that. If they're not allocated weapons because they're part of the medical team, but by 1916, both the medical officers and the stretcher bearers get weapons from home. They get handguns from home and they use it for self-protection. In 1917, when you have all this in Passchendaele with the terrible mud, they use it to put horses and mules who become trapped in the mud out of their misery. But the accounts that I've read where they're easing someone's passing when everybody knows that someone's going to die, they use their morphine supplies for that. They have tablets, but they also have little glass syringes. And so they will give someone 4 or 5 injections of morphine, and eventually that will end their life. I've never heard of anybody using a weapon.
Did we have a lot of morphine? And again, I don't even know if you'll know this question, but was it coming from places like Afghanistan? Was we bringing the morphine in?
I'm afraid I know the answer to that question because it's really important. It's a really important question. The most dreadful thing about casualty, whether it's at the point of wounding or 10 years later, and you know this much better than I do, Michael, because of your dedication to this cohort, is that these wounds are incredibly painful. They are incredibly, enduringly painful. So we needed morphine. Our morphine supplies have primarily come from Iran. They hadn't come from Afghanistan, they'd come from Iran, but they'd come from the parts of Iran that bordered Afghanistan. So ironically, yes. But they reckon very quickly that they're not going to be able to get those supplies from Iran. So there's a huge stimulus for the research and development of morphine substitutes, of chemical morphine substitutes. So when they're given an opiate, it is in fact a synthetic opiate. That's what's distributed, and Britain never has a problem with the supply of analgesia, of painkillers, throughout the war. Whereas in Germany, they didn't do that, and they run out of opioids, or they run out of analgesia and painkillers into 2017, which means you have men screaming for their injuries and very little hope of treatment.
Would each side rob each other's medical kit?
There were aspects of German medical kit that were much better than the British ones. So British stretcher bearers always looked for German medical kit, particularly up to the beginning of 1917, which is when Germany itself collapses. So their supply lines aren't good, and what they can get to the front line is much less well ordered. But in particular, the Germans have sticky bandage. If you think about plasters that you buy in the supermarket, the plaster is a fabric plaster, but it's sticky and it's stretchy. And you can put it on and take it off and put it on and take it off. We never had that. The Germans had developed a glue that did that. They developed it before the war, and it was the best thing ever. And when stretcher bearers, when British troops took German trenches, the bearers always said, could you please get me all the medical supplies you can? But what they're really after, the primo medical supply, is the sticky bandage. lots of sticky bandage rolls in German in the Science Museum, and everybody thinks that they came from a German soldier, but they don't. They come from British stretcher bearer supply bags, because that is what they really want. Soldiers want a Kaiser helmet. They want one of those helmets with the pointy things. That's what they're always looking for. And stretcher bearers are looking for sticky bandage.
The psyche of a soldier and a stretcher bearer.
Yeah.
So I was always, you know, when you're growing up, and I was always fascinated with this part of history. And I didn't truly understand until I was an adult, and I must have watched something or heard something, the amount of time a soldier was actually on the front line, and there was quite a lot of rotation going through the lines. Would the stretcher bearer, would that be the same for the stretcher bearer teams as well? Would they stay on the front line for longer or less?
So they would. The stretcher bearers would stay on the front line for longer. It depends month by month and battalion by battalion. But soldiers are, I think, effectively in the front line for about 3 days, and then they move to the rear. Stretcher bearers are there for longer, and then they don't go quite so far to the rear. They tend to then go to a casualty clearing station or a field hospital. So their proximity to the war is always much. They're always much closer than a soldier, and they don't go back and forth in the same way that soldiers do. So their experience of the war is much more direct and much more ongoing. But because people don't think they're soldiers, that's not considered to be something that we need to be worrying about.
Mm. And then I'm going to talk about the physical and the psychological side in a minute. Before we just move there, the methods of carry. And I love the fact that it was called the carry.
The carry.
And it's such a I don't know, like a visceral thing, isn't it? You know, like the carry. But what were the methods of carry? If you've got a 4, 5, 6-man team, how were they carrying people off these moonscape kind of battlefields?
So if ideally they had the 5 or the 6-man team, they would get the casualty onto, they would make a decision about which casualty to move first. And that's no mean feat, you know, saying who we start for. And then they leave if there's more people, they leave them behind, and they say, we'll be back for you. And everybody has to hope that they can be. But they would get them up, and then they would put the straps over their shoulders, and they would have hopefully be carrying the weight of the stretcher and the casualty on both their shoulders and with their hands, except that the straps would slip and they would have to stop, put everything down, put the straps back up. And then they moved around. So the person who was the leader would become one of the men on the corner. So everybody is changing where they're carrying from, is changing the direction of the weight that they're carrying from. And that works as well as it can down to two men. Two men can carry a heavy stretcher and a patient for not very far. But they learned, one of the things that they learned, it was one of the first things they learned, and it's not really basic. I think it's probably something we have to learn every war. But they think if you take a greatcoat, you can use it as a stretcher. So they put a patient in a greatcoat and they have the 4 stretcher bearers on each corner of the greatcoat. And it's useless because the patient just bundles up in the middle, and if their wounds are bleeding, they'll just open again. So then what they do is they learn that if there's two of you, you do a fireman's lift. One of you carries the patient for a dedicated amount of time and then you swap. That's how you keep a patient alive, and you move quickly if you've only got one stretcher or you've got no stretchers. So it's, again, quite technical. I really like the term the carry because they're recognising what it is they're doing. They're not just saying we're bringing a patient in. They're saying this is something that is a thing in and of its own. The carry is what we do, is what we're expert at. And if there's two of you, you do a fireman's lift. And if there's 5 of you, you remember that you need to change corners. So they understand that process really well.
It's like anything, is it? That's very, very complex. It's the best people make it simple.
Absolutely.
Not easy, but simple.
Simple, exactly,
and
simple.
The carry and everything that involved this complexity, but it's a very simple phrase that is
carry.
Developed and kind of refined exactly. as they went
along. I always want to say, I know CASEVAC is the right phrase, and it is casualty evacuation, but it's the carry. You know, it's the carry. It's complicated. You have to keep the patient alive, and it's physically demanding on you. So, you know, these are the people that came up with the concept of casualty evacuation. And that's remarkable. You know, these are people who have not got medical degrees, who are probably left school at 14, but they're good, sensible people with initiative. And they start off by saying, this is how you handle a stretcher. And they end up by saying, this is how you can bring someone in who's had a double amputation. That's pretty impressive.
And everything is to keep them strong enough to move. So get the right person on the stretcher, keep them strong enough to move them, get them to the next place, and then they'll move further and further back. But each point is to keep them strong enough to move to the next point.
Absolutely. The one thing this isn't about is portering. This is not portering. This is keeping the person, identifying the person who can be moved and the balance between who needs to be moved and who can survive being moved, and then keep them alive on the stretcher. So if they stopped bleeding, keep it so they stop bleeding. Manage their pain, probably by talking to them, probably by developing a relationship, and managing their fear. So one of the things that stretcher bearers also have, they don't have it in their satchels, but they have it in their tent, is they have a box of buttons and a sewing kit, because casualties often claw their tunics and they pull their buttons off. And they want to put their button, and they don't, and the button is lost, it falls in the mud. And it's just the fear of someone's hand reaching out, tearing their tunic, ripping the buttons off, and they have to say, "Calm down, lad, we'll move you." That's what the carry is about. And then when they get back, the first thing they do is repair their tunic very carefully, good thread skills, and sew their buttons back on. Because it's important to them that they go out the next time and they've got all their buttons and their tunic's not torn.
Apart from being shot, having explosions around you, everything that would be on that battlefield at that time, was there anything, any injury or illness that was specific to stretcher bearers?
Not as far as I know, because we know very little about them after the war. We know that they have hand and back problems. We do know that. We know that they often spend the rest of their lives using something called Melrose ointment, which is like a medicated Vaseline on their hands to keep them supple, because their skin on their hands never really recovers. But on the front line, they're exposed to all the same things that the soldiers are, except they're on a carry and they're moving slowly, so that the danger that they face is greater. We know that from 1916, when we start seeing gas being used, that's particularly challenging for stretcher bearers, because they can't run away if they've got a stretcher, if they're carrying a stretcher. They're often sweating quite heavily. So a gas mask, you have to weigh up whether you're going to put a gas mask on. And you also need to get a gas mask on your casualty. So gas has some real challenges for stretcher bearers that they have to resolve. And we do see a number of them who are gassed because they make a decision not to put their gas mask on and to carry through the gas. And then they're in the field hospital for the next 3 or 4 weeks.
It just sounds like the most horrific role to play. The psychological side of this, and again, I don't think many records were kept, and obviously PTSD wasn't what it is now, as in the symptoms and the care and the understanding. But obviously this stuff was still going on. This trauma was still going on. A lot is talked about shell shock, this neurological disorder. But being on the front the way they were, being exposed to the amount of trauma, this life-changing, this life-altering trauma, twinned with the fact that they're making decisions of who to carry off and who to leave, did we see an increase in kind of the psychological or the negative psychological effect of war with stretcher bearers?
We don't know a great deal because of this issue that I can't even tell you how many stretcher bearers there are, because nobody thought it was worth counting. In the official medical history of the war, the official British medical history of the war, there is one mention of stretcher bearers. The actual phrase stretcher bearers is used once. And a general who came back from the Western Front at the end of the war said, "I think we'll forget very quickly who it was secured the lives of all these soldiers. It was the stretcher bearers and the nurses at the field hospital." And he's quite right. We did. We forgot really quickly. There is, I think, what we have to remember, that they choose to be stretcher bearers. Stretcher bearers are all volunteers. And they do it for a couple of reasons. It's generally, you're not being pushed around as much as you are a soldier. You have quite a considerable amount of responsibility, and you are learning a trade that is likely, you're getting training. I think this might be the same in the army today. You do all the training courses you can, because it will be, when you come out of the army, those will be useful. So the stretcher bearers think, if we do the training course, we'll have that on our records. You know, we can go and be a hospital orderly or a hospital porter afterwards. And there's a lot of evidence that they go on and do that. So they have a responsibility. They have a good relationship with their battalion. Very quickly, the battalions learn that you don't shout at the stretcher bearers, that they're the most precious people that you know. So having that responsibility, being able to have those men look at you and be more confident because they know that you're there, that must be, that's quite a reinforcing exchange during the process of the war. It's certainly better than just being a soldier and endlessly digging trenches. But the answer is we don't know how many of them were badly affected by the mental demands day in, day out, month in, month out, year in, year out, that stretcher bearing made, that being the CMT, the paramedic, the first responder, that is immensely physically demanding and psychologically demanding. So I know of one story where a London cab driver, it wasn't me, he was telling my husband, and my husband was going to the Imperial War Museum, and he said, oh, I'll tell you an interesting story. And his, I think, great uncle had been a stretcher bearer and had survived from and had been at the Somme in 1916, from the very first day in July until the very last day in December. And he didn't get a scratch, not a scratch. He must have worked really hard. And then he's sent home on leave, and he comes home on leave to London to see his family, and he sees all his family in their front room. And then he goes up to the bedroom in their little house, and he shoots himself. This is the only account that we have of a direct mental psychological effect on a stretcher bearer, but it is unimaginable that more of them wouldn't have been affected. But we balance that with the knowledge that they gained and the responsibility they gained. And I think very much without any arrogance at all, a quiet pride in the expertise that they've developed, not for only for themselves, but on behalf of the men that they look after and for the whole stretcher bearer cadre. It isn't a cadre, but for the whole profession of stretcher bearers. They developed that and they know it. And I think that you balance the psychological costs alongside the personal satisfaction of so many lives saved and so great an expertise developed in the field.
Are there any records of soldiers, not just obviously stretcher bearers, which we've already ascertained, but soldiers across the board, post-service and suicide? Are there any records around any of that?
I think there are in... you have to go to the National Archives and look that up. And there are many really fine histories of what wasn't PTSD, what was called at that point, it wasn't called PTSD, it was called shell shock. And I would urge anyone who has an interest in that to read books by Edgar Jones, who is just the finest historian of the psychological impact of war, but particularly the Great War. And if anyone can track down the numbers or give a really informed answer about those numbers, it's Professor Jones. His book's great. I can't give you an informed answer on that.
So we look at things like shell shock. We know that, like I've said before, that is a neurological disorder. So the PTSD, you look at a trauma memory problem, and then you look at, and I'm going away slightly from, it's kind of linked, but with not wanting to be there, with a desire to escape, and then firing squads are off the back of that. You know, you go, you leave as a coward. Many of these men were suffering psychologically, but there is a link between stretcher bearers and the firing squads. Can you go into that?
I think this is one of those things where I want people, when they envisage the First World War, particularly on the Western Front, I want them, when they've got that image in their head, I want them to say, where's the stretcher bearer in this? Because the chances are there's a stretcher bearer, and there are bearer parties at every firing squad that executes a man on the Western Front throughout the whole of the war, because they need to move the body. You know, it's bearers that move the body. They need to load the corpse up onto their stretcher and take it away. They take it away for pathology to be done. And then the executed soldier is buried, I think, in an unmarked grave. So the bearer party, who normally spends their time with amongst the living, trying to save people's lives, are ordered to the executions. And they wait quietly behind the firing squad. And then when the firing squad has finished firing and the coup de grace has been administered, it is a stretcher bearer that goes up and undoes the ropes, that has the body collapse into their arms, and then is gathered up onto the stretcher. And they will be five or six stretcher bearers, just as they should be. And then they carry it away. We have a few accounts where that happened. People are, it's almost too awful to write about, but I think the one that was really the most meaningful was a stretcher bearer company that had a very young stretcher bearer. He was very big, he was very tall and very strong, but he was young, and they were ordered to a firing squad that they really didn't, you can imagine, nobody wanted to do that. And the young boy, the officer who was in charge of the firing squad, ordered them to watch, said that they would look up, and the young boy wouldn't. He turned his head away. And the officer came over and moved his head to make him watch. And the young boy was sick all over the officer. And the other stretcher bearers noted that with great approval, that this boy had been sick all over the firing officer just as he was about to give the order to fire. That's really the only detail that I have ever read, but it's unimaginable. I try to see the bearers there, and I try to empathise how it must be to stand there and wait for somebody to be killed, which is the diametric opposite of what they're doing the rest of the day, and how you go back to your unit and they say, where have you been? And do you tell them? I don't know.
Was there a greater sense of meaning beyond saving the life in front of you? Was there, like in the Second World War, that was stopping the Nazis from invading their mothers and wives and things? Was there a greater sense? Did they understand why they were there?
I think we underestimate how much people did think that they were fighting the First World War to stop. I think it was Prussian autarky taking over Europe, you know, to retain a liberal democracy. But I think, like every war, the longer a war goes on, the more you fight it for your mates. You fight it for the men in the unit, the battalion around you. And I think for stretcher bearers, their service is about getting better and better at their job and being able to save more and more of the mates around them. It's very much about working with the team, working with the regimental medical officer. So I think certainly by the end of 1915, they're doing it for their mates. They're doing it because they have a very strong sense of medical responsibility. It's the most interesting thing for a historian. You always have to pay attention word by word when you look at sources. When stretcher bearers write home, which isn't very often, they start talking about their patients. So they see the men on their stretchers, not as soldiers, not as people in the same battalion, but as their patients. So just like a doctor's primary motivation is to save the life of their patients, I think that's the stretcher bearer's primary motivation.
Would the medical officers and the stretcher teams, would they have a relationship, or was it very much like junior NCOs and officers?
Most of the evidence I have seen is for remarkably close relationships developing between the RMOs and the stretcher bearer team. So in particular, whoever the team leader would be, he would work with the RMO, and men would get used to seeing them together, and they would see them as two halves of the same coin. RMOs don't go out to point of wounding. They're not supposed to. Occasionally they do, but they don't go out to point of wounding. They wait in the casualty clearing station or the aid post, and the bearers will bring them their patients who are not dead, who have survived, because the carry is a medically informed process. So RMOs absolutely understand that they can't do anything without stretcher bearers, and they treat them with the greatest possible respect. There's a real closeness. They don't, you know, no one's training, no one's talking down. They are equals in the casualty continuum, and they have much to teach each other. And all good RMOs, and they're mostly the ones that I've studied, they respect that totally.
Something that's popped into my head then, I should have probably asked it early on. Were their diets the same? Did they get more calories, or did men give them, how did it work?
So they all got allocated the same food ration. Somebody would come around with a food ration, or if they were in camp, they would queue up to get their food ration. But one of the things that works amazingly well all the way through the First World War is the postal system. So they ask their family to send them extra food because they know that they're burning through more calories than soldiers are. So they get their family to send them chocolate and bread and anything that they can get in an envelope. And it gets to them really quickly. I know of one regimental medical officer who asks for chocolate and scissors for his stretcher bearers. And his wife sends them from Aberdeen, and it gets to the Western Front in 24 hours. You can't do that anymore. I don't think you get a parcel from Aberdeen in 24 hours anymore. But this parcel came in 24 hours. So although they get the same food rations, they understand the carry is heavy and difficult, so they're going to need the extra calories. So in addition to needing the sleep, they also need the food. So they get food if they go into a captured trench, then they, if there's food left behind, they'll take that food. They'll take any food they can get, but their families send them whatever they can afford and whatever they can get to the post office, and then they eat that.
I've got a couple of questions. I'm always fear I'm going to forget a question, but I'll ask this one first.
Yeah.
So we've got a need for stretcher bearers. They're highly prized, but we also have lots of conscientious objectors in the country, especially when it's linked with religion, like the Quaker religion. Is that a thing? Do they recruit from religious organizations? And the second thing is, was it perceived in the population society back in the UK as any form of cowardice, or was it revered and was it kind of uplifted by society?
So I think about 30% of all stretcher bearers, and in fact all people who worked within the medical system who weren't qualified doctors were conscientious objectors, and the majority of those would have been Quakers. And so it's so important to the Quaker faith that they open their own stretcher bearer training course at their headquarters at Didcot. And they train up medics to work as stretcher bearers, as ambulance drivers, as medical orderlies throughout the course of the war. And in fact, during the war, I think a lot of soldiers assume that their bearers will be Quakers. And they ask, and they say, "Are you a Quaker?" And the bearer goes, "No, you know, I'm from the East End. I'm just from the East End." But 30% of them would have been. And it becomes very strongly associated in the minds of the soldiers. And I think, although the population has a disdain for conscientious objectors, very quickly they work out that conscientious objectors who go to the front are brave in the same way that soldiers are. There are some quite hardcore conscientious objectors who won't serve the war in any way. So they end up being sent to prison or working on roads or becoming teachers. And they certainly experience more public condemnation. But the association of the Quaker religion, of religious conscientious objectors and stretcher bearing, is made very quickly in the minds of the public. And they just assume that that's the case. I don't know if you've ever seen a film called Hacksaw Ridge, which is about an extraordinary stretcher bearer in the American Medical Corps in the Second World War. And he's a Quaker. And his experience of, he does receive a great deal of abuse when he goes to training camp, but by the time he gets to his posting, people have an enormous respect for his skills and they're just grateful to see him. And that's quite typical. This is something that's closely associated. You can be a stretcher bearer, you can be a paramedic, a CMT, and your faith will be respected.
Mm.
I think it was that
film Hacksaw Ridge that made me think about that, you know, like how people's perception was, if you're not carrying a weapon then you're a coward, but in that film especially, it's a true, I think I had tears in my eyes watching it because he was just the most amazing individual. It's all a true story.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that film does, I mean, it's different because it's set in America. So America comes into the war very late. It doesn't have the relationship with stretcher bearers over 4 or 5 years that we do in the United Kingdom. So it's not a role that's particularly well understood. And people forget, people remembered for about a decade that stretcher bearers and conscientious objection was often the same thing. But then they forgot. Another generation came up and it had to be explained to them all over again, or people simply forgot.
Well, that's a perfect link then. So what was learned, if anything, moving on from history? So what was learned end of 2018? What did the medical professional, what did the military, what did ambulance services learn from those stretcher bearers that dug in and, you know, saved lives for 4 years?
What's really depressing is that we didn't really learn anything. Stretcher bearers went home, and because they were people from the lower ranks of society, they weren't summoned before Parliament to give a testimony to the official history or to create new facilities. We learned very little, and it's a lesson we've relearned war after war after war, and that is that you move your medical capability as far forward as it will go, and that is paramedics. It took us a century to work out the value of stretcher bearers. What's really interesting about them, though, is what they learn themselves. And what appears to be common amongst surviving returnees is that the theory they had, that the training course they took to become stretcher bearers would be useful, they're right. They do go and get jobs in hospitals. There are a lot of hospitals after they become much bigger. There's a lot of hospitals looking after veterans who are going to be there for a long time. Bearers go and work there. They work as medical orderlies, as theatre assistants. They get one up. Their job level goes one up. What's really interesting is that it appears taking on that responsibility, having that surety of your own expertise, is something that they communicate to their families, because their children go on to have possibly a professional career. I meet a lot of doctors who've got stretcher bearers in their family. And I think that stretcher bearers come back and their expertise is communicated to their families, and they have the confidence to continue in education, to do secondary education, possibly even a college education. And by the time you get to their grandchildren, they're fully qualified professionals. And I think that's what the stretcher bearers have taught their families. Maybe if they even didn't teach them actually, you know, specifically, their confidence and their expertise and the guidance that they can offer their families is something that communicates and translates into advancement.
I want to leapfrog us, and I want to go from the carry, and I want to go over leapfrog us over the World War II career, and put us straight into, I suppose, Afghanistan. Really, the modern conflict of Afghanistan. Was there the carry to a Kazivak? They're different in many ways. Technologically, it's a different era. Advancements, all this, but were principles similar?
I think that the principles that end up being applied in Afghanistan by the equivalent stretcher bearers, which is a combat medical technician, which is allocated to every unit, everyone has a CMT, and they are, in to my mind, stretcher bearers. I mean, I think our main problem with the history of stretcher bearers is that they haven't got a good name. We need to give them a better name, but they would be cross with that because they identified with their name. But CMTs don't have the physical carry. They're never going to have to do that. They're never going to have to go for 3 hours through the mud with their shoulders being torn and their hands being wrecked. But they are responsible for the men in their unit or their patrol group in just the same way. And the men in their patrol group or their unit will depend on them. They will look at them to be able to get whatever they need out of the Bergen on their back to save their lives and keep it saved until the helicopter lands or the ambulance comes. And I think that principle, that someone who's not a qualified doctor but does have a specialist training course, can bring care at the very point of wounding. And in Afghanistan, it really is the point of wounding. The IED goes off, and while the blast is still ringing in their ears, the CMT is at work on the patient, is applying the tourniquets, applying the dressings. That principle of point of wounding care, of making somebody strong enough to survive to the next phase of their treatment. Whether I think I could pick up any CMT or any stretcher bearer a century apart and switch them over, and they would absolutely recognise the environment in which they work.
And interestingly enough, those on the ground in Afghanistan loved and respected their stretcher bearers, in brackets, as much as a First World War soldier at the Battle of the Somme.
Absolutely. I mean, it is almost like if you want to know the answer to a question about stretcher bearers, ask someone who knew a CMT well during their time in Afghanistan. And if you want to know a question about CMTs, ask the stretcher bearers. Go get in your time machine. And if you have a time machine, I would like to borrow it because I'm a historian and I need it. Get in your time machine and go and ask the stretcher bearers. But it is about that closeness of that relationship. And I think this comes back to your question about why they do it. They do it because they know that they hold the safety and the lives of the group that they work in their hands. And that's a big responsibility, but if you're able to discharge that responsibility, that's a matter of very considerable personal satisfaction. And I don't think that's changed across a century.
Did stretcher bearers in 1916, did they train the troops they were with on basic first aid and basic trauma care like a combat medic would do now?
There's less of that. It's one of it where it is different. The body care, self-care and body care that we know about today is really quite effective. The idea of having, you know, being able to apply a tourniquet very quickly to yourself or to your friend has really saved a lot of lives. In the First World War, it wasn't so much. All soldiers were given one field dressing, a number one field dressing, and a tiny bottle of iodine, really tiny. If you think about one of those bottles of food colouring that you would have, really tiny, really difficult to get open, incredible. You're supposed to splash it on your wound. You know, if you've just been shot and you're covered in mud and you're in the bottom of you're in your moonscape, that's not going to work. And you've got one dressing, that's not going to work. So there wasn't the principle of self-care. That was something that we really learned in the 21st century.
And was it all direct pressure, or did they understand tourniquets and indirect pressure?
It was all direct pressure because there was a concern that if you applied a tourniquet that you would lose the limb that the tourniquet was being applied to. And of course, they have a point that that does generally happen. But we now understand that you apply a tourniquet not because you're trying to save the limb, but because you're trying to save the life. So stretcher bearers do everything by applying direct pressure and using a stack of the field dressings that they have in their satchels, in their panniers. There is a way, this actually really works for the way that the carry works, because people in Afghanistan always say, you know, you whack on a tourniquet and then you can work on the rest of the wounds. Stretcher bearers couldn't do that. They had to pay attention to the wound where they were applying pressure. They had to understand if the patient was bleeding again. And they had to understand that not just if there was blood coming through the dressings, but if the patient was getting pale or unconscious or their speech was becoming slurred. And this requires them to monitor the patient really closely during the carry. So in a way, this decision, which we now think is a bit silly, that not to give them tourniquets, and tourniquets did exist, not to give them tourniquets was something that really developed their expertise. So when you're looking at medical history, you have to look at what people have got and also what people haven't got, because medical developments are made on both those circumstances in mind. They haven't got tourniquets, so they have to work harder to save the life of the patient. So they become much more skilled at saving the life of the patient. And that's where we get to with that. It's very interesting.
And we are in 2022, October. And I know the department you sit in is linked to stuff that's happening right now. And historians love to see what's happening now and in the future and then reflect back on the past. With what's happening around the world, especially in Eastern Europe, are we looking at going back to a World War One style of stretcher bearer?
I think we easily might. The first thing I want to say is I'm going to be very interested to hear about the physical demands that your carry makes on you, and how quickly you work out that it hurts your hands and your shoulders, and that's difficult to live with, knowing you've got quite a while to go. But yes, I think so. I think we got briefly used to in Afghanistan to the idea that you could evacuate casualties very quickly. What if we can't do that? And I strongly suspect that in most of the wars that we fight, I would prefer if we didn't fight them, because I'm a historian and I know they never work. But no one ever, you know, people only listen to historians up to a point. So if we're going to fight them and casualties are going to be left in the field for hours or possibly even days, it's the person who is with them at the point of wounding, so the stretcher bearer, the combat medical technician, who will save their life during that period, who will keep their life saved in a hole in the ground that looks like a moonscape. If they're lucky, they found a bit of corrugated iron to keep the rain off. They will be allocating the supplies they have to those people until the helicopter comes or the ambulance comes or another medical team comes to evacuate them. Those are the skills that are going to keep people alive. I think we talk about prolonged field care. And people talk to me about that like it's something they just invented. If you want to know how to do that, I can tell you how to do that. And the stretcher bearers of the First World War will tell you how to do that. Because that's the only person, that's the only place where that expertise is. Keeping people alive for hours and even days in a hole in the ground is something we learned how to do to an extraordinary high level in the First World War.
It's let's hope history doesn't repeat itself, although I expect in some respects it will. But thank the Lord for the stretcher bearer and everything is. Emily, you know what? It's it shines a spotlight, doesn't it, on people that are not recognised enough. And even when you're talking, you're like, well, this must be a film. There must be a World War One British film there.
Do you know what? I'm happy with Hacksaw Ridge. It's the kind of thing that I can say, well, watch Hacksaw Ridge, see what the demands that were made on them, you know, see the circumstances that they worked in for days and days at a time, you know, when it's all down to them. Hacksaw Ridge will do, but I would like her. It would be nice. It would be nice.
Well, I think it's that shuttle, you know, that four-day shuttle is very kind of full on.
Very, very full on. Yeah, very full on. And, you know, and it's 4 days if you're lucky, if everything's working. If you're stuck in a hole on the moonscape and you can't get out, you know, and the battle's raging, then it's going to be longer. But it's the idea that you're there at point of wounding. That's who it is. It's no one else. It's not someone with a fancy medical degree or an officer. It's these men. Now it's men and women who have, and they have the same skills that were required as stretcher bearers. They've got initiative and they've got strength of character and they've got courage. And then they've got technical training skills as well, but they're no good if you haven't got the initiative and strength of character and courage. That hasn't changed across the century and it won't change across the wars.
This has inspired me for what's coming next week. And I will make sure this comes out before that. I was going to put it out when we were actually doing our stretcher carry, but I'm going to do it before so the guys can listen and be motivated and driven and inspired by those that went before them, albeit in a different manner, at a different time, and certainly not under a hail of bullets and explosions. But still, it's
you know, the physicality, the exhaustion that you're going to experience. As long as you know what the other side, you know, you're doing what they're doing, which is you're experiencing this very physically demanding process. And your mind is, you're not carrying a patient, but you're carrying history. So I want you to spend 50% of your time thinking about the people who did that in the Great War, you know, who endured the same physical demands that you're enduring. And then their brain is, 50% of their brain is taken up with their patient. In your case, it would be good if 50% of your brain is taken up with the people that you're walking for and the history of the people who walked before you. That would be my challenge.
Emily, that's it. That's going to be the punchline, the strap line, and the motivation behind everything. Thank you so much. We'll leave it there.
Thank you.